isn't God? What is he not like? And what doesn't he require of us? These may sound like the rhetorical musings of a pantheistic pagan who thinks that everything is God. But they're actually the philosophical reflections of ancient theologians known as apophatic theology. What is apophatic theology? Well, the word itself is just a Latin transliteration of the Greek apophatikos, from apophani. The word itself is derived from the combination of the Greek preposition apo, which means from or away from, and phanai, which means to speak. So we think of a denial, of a negation, to speak away from. And when we think of apophatic theology then, we are thinking of a negative theology. Now what does that mean? Well, it means to describe God by the things that cannot be said of him, by the things that are not true of him. It is the opposite of what is called cataphatic theology, which is what we've been using for a number of weeks now to come to a better understanding of who God is by making positive statements about what can be said about him. And that can be done because of the immanence of God. God is knowable. But as the ancient Christians realized, we can't really know exactly what language means when we use it to describe God. And that's because God is not just immanent, he is also transcendent. He is other. And when it comes to his attributes, take love for example, his love is perfect. His love is pure. His love is infinite. It is not like any love that we have ever experienced. It is unique, which means that these positive descriptions of God are something that we can only really understand by way of analogy. It is like this. It is like that that we have experienced. We can understand what God is like, but we can't fully grasp the extent of what these words mean, because he is unique. All right, his possession of these attributes is one of a kind. So when I think of these theologians, these ancient ones like the Cappadocian Fathers, they will focus on the things that God is not in order to gain a better understanding of who he is by way of negation. And we're going to pull a page from them as we study our text today. We are going to be back in Exodus chapter 34, if you'll meet me there. Exodus chapter 34, we are still looking at verses 6 and 7. Exodus 34, verse 6. The Lord passed by in front of Moses and proclaimed, The Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. That is who God is. That is what he is like. And if we are to exhibit godliness, if we desire to be like God, that is what he requires of us. So what does that mean? It is a question we've been chewing on for a number of weeks now. And through our study of the terms in this text and the way which God demonstrates them in his story, I hope we've come to recognize in more meaningful ways what it means for God to be compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth. Today, I'd like to continue unpacking this text, but to do so, we're going to need to go in a slightly different direction than we have in previous weeks. And the reason for that is because the description in our text today has less to do with God's character and more to do with our own. Look back at verse 7. God is one who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. Now, we're going to talk about the significance of the verb that's translated as forgives at a later time. But first, we need to consider what is being forgiven. Iniquity, transgression, and sin. Now, the first question that comes to my mind is, what is the difference? Is there a difference? Or is just God just being redundant here? If you're like me, when you come across these words in a text, your inclination has been to just substitute the concept of sin wherever they appear. So for someone to bear their iniquity, that just means they are suffering for their sin. Or if someone has committed a transgression, they've sinned. But in doing that, I was making a big mistake. Because these words aren't simply the product of a modern interpreter's imagination. They're not something that was added to the text just to smooth out our translations with a little bit of variety. They are actually translations of different Hebrew words. And while they may bear some relationship to one another, their meanings are not identical. You know, kind of like different dog breeds, right? They're all in the canine family, but a Dutch hound and a Doberman are not the same dog. Right. They may have similarity, but they're different. These words represent different offenses to God. Different things that He is not, and yet He forgives them. So how do they differ? Well, today we're just going to focus on one of the three, and it's the one that we should be most familiar with. Sin. What is sin? According to Merriam-Webster, the term either refers more broadly to an offense against a religious or moral law, or more specifically, to a transgression of the law of God. Is that right? The larger Westminster Catechism mostly agrees. Question 24. What is sin? Answer. Sin is any want of conformity unto or transgression of any law of God given as a rule to the reasonable creature. Again, I ask, is that right? Let's put the question of theological accuracy aside for the moment and just make some observations about language. Just language. Every discipline has technical language. And we call it shop talk. Or in churches, we call it Christianese. it's those words that have theological significance for us. There are special vocabulary. Words like salvation. As Protestants, when we talk about salvation, we get the whole gospel packed in there. I mean, you got deliverance from wrath, resurrection from the dead, eternal life, the whole deal. And that's good. And it is helpful when we're talking to each other. But what is not good is when we read the word salvation in the way we understand it, when we read it in the Bible, and then automatically import our meaning into the text. That is not good. Why is that a problem? Because our meaning is not necessarily their meaning. We're making a theological observation here. Okay, we're saying, in the concept of soteriology, the study of salvation, this is what it means. But that doesn't mean every time we see the word, that's what it means. You know, it depends on context. Context is going to tell us what the author is talking about. He gets to call how he's using the word. And we know that. I mean, nobody mistook the TV series Saved by the Bell to be a treatise on soteriology. We understand. They're not talking about the faith. They're not talking about eternity. They're talking about being stuck in a classroom. Same thing is true for sin. To understand what it means, we got to look at how the term is used. And then after we've understood the biblical text, then we can make some theological observations. Then we can associate the word with various meanings for our own purposes. So let's start at the beginning. In our text, Exodus 34, the Hebrew word that is translated as sin is katah. Katah. It's variously translated throughout the Old Testament. It could be sin, it could be wrong, it could be offend, it could be miss, it could be err. In the Old Testament, it appears in one form or another almost 600 times. So it's a very common word. Consider how it's used in Isaiah. Listen to this. This is just Isaiah 65, verse 20. Listen to it. I'm going to use the ESV translation first so that you can hear it. Speaking of the new heavens and the new earth, we read, "No more shall there be," this is Isaiah 65, 20, "No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed." There's our word. The sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. And while sinner obviously is a fine translation of the word here, right? There's a range of meaning, and this is one of the acceptable meanings within that range. The translation doesn't seem to fit with the information we just read before, with what we would call the context in this text. You know, we're talking about the situation in the new heavens and the new earth and the lifespan of the people living in it. With that in mind, notice how the New American Standard will translate this same text. "No longer will there be in it," that's the new heavens and the new earth, "no longer will there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his days. For the youth will die at the age of 100, and the one who does not reach the age of 100 will be thought accursed." You see the difference? See, according to the ESV, we're talking about a 100-year-old sinner, but the NASB translators think we're talking about a person who fails to reach the age of 100. There is a standard. They didn't reach the standard. They missed it. Let's look at how it appears in another text. Proverbs 19. Proverbs 19. This time I'm going to start with the New King James Version so you can see the word. I want you to see the word in the text. Proverbs 19, verse 2. "It is not good for a soul to be without knowledge, and he sins who hastens with his feet." What is he saying? It's the punchline of the proverb. Those who get in a hurry sin. Yes. But in what way? Are they cutting corners because they're in a hurry? So they're doing something bad? Are they running afoul of the rules? Or is something else happening? Let's give the ESV another chance. Listen to what they have to say. This is the ESV's translation of Proverbs 19:2. "Desire without knowledge is not good, and whoever makes haste with his feet misses his way." Now, what does that mean? Sounds a little bit better. You get in too much of a hurry, you're liable to get off track somewhere along the way. You're going to miss your exit. All right? If you get going, I want to get rich quick. What's the shortcut? I'm trying to get there. I'm never going to make it. You know, I have ignored the right road. I've taken the wrong path. I've gotten off. I've missed my destination. One more. Listen to Judges chapter 20. Judges chapter 20, verse 16. This is speaking of the soldiers of Benjamin. The text says that out of all these people, the 700 choice men were left-handed. Each one could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Now that is accurate. Where was the word in our text? It was at the end, wasn't it? They can sling a stone at a hare and not sin. Not miss their target. Not miss their mark. They don't fail to hit the hare. They're accurate. That's our word. And I actually think that that rendering of the concept works for each of the texts that we've just mentioned. The old man misses the target age of 100. The person who makes haste misses the target destination that they were aiming for. And of course, the lefties from Benjamin can sling and not miss their target. And that's probably not a surprise to most of you. This is somewhat of a commonly known fact. You've probably heard before that sin basically means to miss the mark. And that's right. But it doesn't go far enough. Listen to the words of Charles Ryrie. He points out that missing the mark also involves hitting some other mark. Meaning, when one misses the right mark and thus sins, he also hits the wrong mark. The idea is not merely a passive one of missing, but also an active one of hitting. It reminds me of Matt Emmons. In 2004, Matt Emmons was at the Olympics in Athens competing in the three-position event, where marksmen take shots from their stomachs, from their knees, and from their feet at targets 50 meters away. And from the very start, he had dominated the competition. And now he was just one mediocre shot away from the gold medal. And so he takes his position one last time. He aims the rifle at a target, takes a deep breath, fires. Bullseye. But the computer registers nothing. He shrugs, calls over the judges. They shrug too. Did the gun malfunction? The computer malfunction? Neither. Emmons had hit a target, but it was the wrong target. See, he dropped from first place to eighth, from gold medal to empty-handed, because he hit the wrong bullseye. I usually always look through the scope at the number above the target first and then drop down to the target, said Emmons, who said he has never had a crossfire in international competition, nor anywhere else in the last 6 years. On the last shot, I didn't look at the target number first, he added. I was just working on calming myself down and getting a good shot off. I should have looked. So sin, it's missing the right mark, but it's also hitting the wrong mark. Now, theologically speaking, the question naturally arises. What is the right mark? If we don't know what we're supposed to be aiming for, what are the odds that we're going to be able to hit it? Somewhere around zero. Somewhere in that ballpark. Zero. So it's very important that we identify the right target. We don't want to be like Matt Emmons. We want to check the number, make sure we're shooting in the right direction at the right target. So what is the right target? Well, to discover that, we're going to have to go down and get to the root of sin. We're going to have to look at its origin story. It's something that Paul's going to speak about in Romans chapter 5, so I'm going to make a brief detour there. Romans chapter 5, I'm just going to look at verses 12 through 14. In Romans chapter 5, verse 12, Paul begins walking his audience through the biblical story. Because as you remember in the book of Romans, these people are claiming that Paul's gospel is at odds with the Old Testament. And he says, it ain't at odds with the Old Testament. My gospel actually comes from the Old Testament. It is derived from the Old Testament. And if you guys can't see that, let me help you. Have you not read? Let me walk you through it. So that's what he does. And in chapter 5, verse 12, he starts right at the very beginning saying, "Therefore, just as through one man the sin entered into the world, and the death through the sin, and so the death spread to all men because all sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world. But sin is not imputed, reckoned, accounted, when there is no law. Nevertheless, the death reigned from Adam until Moses, even those who over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam, who is a type of the coming one." The Greek word for sin that we find in our text and all throughout the Old Testament is hamartia. And its meaning is the same as kata, miss the mark. Same meaning. And as I've mentioned before when we were studying through the book of Romans, that this is a very special use. Paul is making a very special use of hamartia in chapters 5 through chapter 7 in this book. Because he's not just talking about hamartia in general, sin in general. He puts an article before it. It is a very unusual construction that doesn't hardly appear at all in the New Testament. But in these chapters, it's like almost every other verse. Te hamartia, the sin. And it'll appear like, you know, you come to chapter 6:1, what shall we say? Are we to continue in sin? Is how the New American Standard renders that. Completely wrong. It's not a verb. It's a noun. Are we to continue in the sin? The one sin. The singular sin. What's the sin, Paul? He's like, well, we had to start at the beginning, so I can tell you. The sin. The sin of Adam. The sin in a technical, theological sense of the word. The sin of the one man. Because through that one man, the sin entered into the world. That was its inception for the human race. Who was the one man? Adam. What is the sin? See, when we're normally, when you listen to people preach on Romans in this area, 5, 6 especially, 7, or you read a commentary, we're talking about sin, you're talking about what? Bad stuff. Are we going to keep on doing bad stuff now that we've got grace? Licentiousness? Are you going to run around and keep living in immorality so that God's grace might abound? Now, is that what the Jews in Rome want to do? Do they have an interest in this lawless lifestyle? Absolutely not. In fact, that is their entire argument against Paul. If you were to go back and look at chapter 3 and chapter 4, they're accusing him of nullifying the law. You're going against the law. You're lowering the bar for these Gentiles. But if you're following the argument through 5 through 7, you're going to find that by the time you get to chapter 7, he's talking about the law. Don't you know, brothers, chapter 7, verse 1, for I'm speaking to those who know the law, that the law has jurisdiction over people as long as he lives? You know, it's this legalism they want. They want to have law and grace. Can we have it both together? Paul says you absolutely cannot. Why? Because that is the sin. What's the sin? What did Adam do? He took from the tree that God had instructed him not to eat of. Why? He desired to become like God. And now the irony of that is that Adam was actually made in the likeness of God. He was already like God. But he wanted to be his own God. Meaning, he wanted to call right and wrong for himself. See, that's why Paul's going to say, desiring to become wise, they became fools. And so the sin entered the world, and through it, the death. But what does this tell us about the sin? You know, what's the theological significance of that decision? Adam wanted to be like God, and in a way, he already was, and he wasn't. But now, post-fall, things have turned around. His previous likeness to God has been lost, and he has gained a new way in which he is like God. How so? It's all about character. Character. No longer does Adam see right and wrong, good and evil, beauty and ugly, solely through the lens of what God reveals it to be. God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. Now Adam's eyes have been opened. And he is able to see, he is able to determine right and wrong for himself. He has become self-righteous. He has his own idea of self-rightness. He has become self-justified. And that is the sin. The sin of self-rightness. It is the missing of the mark. And it cannot be mixed with grace. So what is the mark? We're talking about all this. What is the mark? Merriam-Webster and Westminster say it is the law. Any want of conformity unto or transgression of any law of God given as a rule to the reasonable creature. Is that right? Are we worried about conforming to the law? That sounds something like a Pharisee might say. Just keep the law, dude. Get it together. 613 commands, you get those down, you're solid. You're golden. As long as you're not breaking any explicit commands, you're good. Is that right? Why would we even care about the law? What is the law? The law is the revelation of the character of God. It is the description when Israel had become a nation that was supposed to be the national representatives of God to the nations of the world, because through them all the families of the earth are going to be blessed through the coming of Messiah. God says, well, you're going to have to know how to represent me. So he gives them the law, the revelation of his character. It tells in this instance, in that instance, here's some ways that my character will apply. It's not exhaustive, is it? It's the revelation of the character of God. So I think of the words of the founder of Dallas Theological Seminary, Lewis Sperry Chafer, who notes that inasmuch as the law of God may not incorporate all that God's character is, and inasmuch as anything will be sinful which contradicts God's character, whether expressed in his law or not, this definition, the Westminster Catechism's definition, is strengthened when the word character is substituted for the word law, which is exactly what I memorized when I first came to faith, reading through systematic theology. It is any failure of conformity to or transgression against the character of God. It's about his character over against everything else. It is any failure of conformity to that character. The character of God is the target. The character of God is the mark. I think of the words of Jesus. Matthew 5, Sermon on the Mount. You must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Okay, your righteousness better exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees or you're going to the pit. And P.S., the righteousness of the Pharisees is pretty good. That's about 99%. They're getting up there. They're trying to keep that law. They don't make it. You got to be not 99%, not 99.9%. You got to be perfect, 100% the character of God. Which is why Christ there reveals himself as the righteousness of God in a man. And he says, ask, seek, knock, because that is the only way you are getting in, is through me. So I think of this. And Chafer is also going to put it this way. He's going to say, sin is sinful because it is unlike God. Now that's helpful. It is unlike God. It is other than his character. That's helpful. Now, who is the one who is unlike God in the story? You know, we think of God. God is the main character. He's the one that has a problem. Genesis 3, his creation, man is not representing him. The main character is the one with the problem. He's the one that's going to fix it. He's the protagonist. And the opposite of the protagonist is the antagonist. Who is the antagonist in the story? Satan, the serpent of old, the dragon. Okay, he's the one that comes in, and whatever God says, he says the opposite. And God says, eat from this tree, you will die. Satan says, you will surely not die. They are diametrically opposed. And so it's not surprising to me that if we were to look in the text, if we were to start in Genesis and just work our way through, the very first time that we will come across our word in the text is in chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, right after the fall, we're looking for the coming son who's going to fix everything. Here's Cain, here's Abel, two sons. We're watching him. They start bringing in sacrifices. Listen to it. This is Genesis chapter 4, verse 3. It came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel on his part also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering. But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. So Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and the NASB renders it, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. But that is not actually what the text says. The pronoun in the text is not neutral. It is a masculine pronoun. It is a second person masculine singular. It doesn't say sin's crouching at the door and its desire is for you. It says sin is crouching at the door and his desire is for you. But you got to rule over him. Or you will rule over him, or you must rule over him. His desire. Whose desire? Who did we just meet in the story? Who's the only bad guy in the story? Chapter 3. It's the serpent. It's Satan. He is the manifestation of the sin. He is all that is opposed to the target. You got God. You got Satan. Two teams on this story. Nothing else. So I think of this. I think of Satan as the personification of sin. I also think of Paul's personification in Romans 6. We're just looking at Romans, where he's going to describe our former estate as slaves to the sin. And the sin is master over us. Remember, what sin? Self-rightness. That's why in chapter 7 he says, look, you know, I was trying to follow the law, but when the law said, thou shalt not covet, I was shot dead. All kinds of coveting in me. I couldn't do a thing about it. When I was trying to pat myself on the back saying, see, Paul, you are right. You are justified before God because you keep his law. I realized in that very moment I was condemning myself as I looked at my brothers and esteemed them as less than me. I am right in comparison to these guys. I know I'm not perfect, but I'm doing pretty good compared to them. He says, no, man, I was dead as a doornail. The sin, and that's what the problem was in Romans, right? They wanted to keep self-rightness, justification through law-keeping, and grace. He says, that's like oil and water. That doesn't even make any sense. You can't have God's righteousness and your own righteousness. It's one or the other, guys. You got to pick a side. Can't mix them together. That don't make no sense. So no, it's his righteousness or nothing. So with Paul, what he was talking about, he was meaning when he was saying that we were in bondage to the sin, he was saying we're either in bondage to our fallen character by which we attempt to merit ourselves to God through our own self-righteousness, or we are freed by availing ourselves of God's righteousness through His grace given in Christ. It is the free gift, acknowledging that we cannot merit His standard. I don't meet His standard. I don't hit that target. My self-righteousness is not what's right in His sight. And so we rely completely on the righteousness of another, the righteousness of Christ. We count our self-righteousness as worthless, right? Filthy rags. Whatever was of gain to me, that was lost in the eternal sense. It just didn't do a thing for me. Now, a lot more could be said, but I just want to focus our attention on one last thing as we close. We've been considering the theological ramifications of sin, you know, sin as missing the mark and hitting the wrong mark, and we were thinking of the theological ramifications of sin as anything then other than the character of God, our fallen characters, which deviate from His. And though we may deviate from His perfection in many, many ways, there is one very important way we need to consider as it relates to our text in Exodus 34, as it relates to this revelation of the character of God. And that one important point is this: we are not consistent. We are not consistent. We come up with our own standards based on our own wicked characters that are convenient for us in this temporal moment of my life. It shows me to be in the right. But those standards also change when it becomes convenient for us, do they not? I mean, watch the news for a week. The news cycle goes on long enough, you'll see a contradiction in the same week. The standard will change based on which political party has committed the offense. We will justify the one, we will condemn the other for the same offense. You know, we say you shouldn't steal until we steal, and then it's like, well, in this instance you can steal, but other than that. Do not murder. But when we murder, well, that's just a clump of cells. That's not murder. Our standard just is not consistent. It's all over the place. Our characters are moving targets. They're moving targets. But remember, we're thinking negative theology towards God, right? What does that mean for us that we can know about Him? Our characters are moving targets. His character is not a moving target. God's perfection is a fixed target. There is no shadow of turning with Him. As He has been, He forever shall be. He is different than us. He is the same. And thank God for that. So what about us? I think of a text like our text today, and I think of all of the implications it has for us. And I think of all the riches now that we have in Christ Jesus. And we say, what has changed for the believer? Here we've had this wicked character. It doesn't mean that I can't recognize that I don't God's standard and that I'm different. Surely the unbeliever can recognize that. I just hate it. But something has changed when we have accepted the free gift of grace in God. There's been a change in the believer. It's the new covenant. I will give you a new heart. I will put a new spirit within you. We're talking about heart. What are we talking about? What does the heart represent? It is our character. You know, the seat of the mind is in the heart, or the kidneys, you know, if I'm an ancient Near Eastern person. It's down here. This is where my decisions are made. It's not necessarily up here. It's about what the heart wants, the heart desires. We're in the West, we say, hey, the heart pumps blood. Okay? It's about what you're thinking. But not to them. We're talking about the heart. He's going to give me a new heart. He's going to give me a new character, a new nature. And it's not going to be like the old one. It's going to be just like His. Now, that doesn't mean that we become You know, we're all automatons. We have the same, you know, we're kind of like the Stepford Wives, and now we all act and talk the same. What it does is it changes our desires. And we say, but I still sin, Caleb, I still sin. Well, you're still in this world, and you still have that wicked character too. And you're going to have to wrestle with that. But the reason what has changed is now I have God's character as well. And the act of glorification is going to be the removal of that wicked character and the retaining of this righteous character that cannot fall. That's why 1 John says, no one who is born of God sins, and he cannot sin because he has been born of God. What does that mean? That you've been born from above, and the new character that you've been given does not act like the old character that you presently have. It cannot fall. That's the one that's going into the kingdom. So sanctification, I am becoming more comfortable with this new character. I'm living in light of this new character. And as I understand the Lord better through His Word better, I understand better how to employ this new character. It is not what I do because I have to do these things. I actually want to do these things. I've received mercy, and it makes me want to give mercy. But there will come a time when sanctification ends. It won't be in this life. I will either go to the grave or I'll meet you in the air. But at that point, we will receive a new body. I will be glorified. This old character gone, I will be remade. And I'll be just like him. Of his character. Perfection. And I'll have it forever. Think of Matt Emmons. You know, he found out you can hit a bullseye and still come out a loser. You know, if you got your eye on the wrong target, if we're seeking the wrong thing in this life, we can even achieve that end. None of it matters. It only matters if we have our eye on the right target. You know, Christ is going to say, seek first his kingdom. All this other junk will be added. When? You know, is it a name it, claim it, health and wealth, Joel Osteen, whoever? You know, if you're actually, you know, that's the Pharisee theology. If God is pleased with you, he'll be blessing your business. No, that has never worked. Didn't work for Abel. Didn't work for any of the prophets. Didn't work for Jesus. Didn't work for the apostles. None of them. No, when? When the kingdom comes, these things will be added. So keep your mind on things above where Christ is, because that is where your help will come, where your deliverance will come, where your life will come when the King comes.